Tonight we have Dr. Hovera from the University of Louisville, and he will talk about real space laser.
Yes. So,
thank you.
What the technology holds, that's the caveat here. We think for most of our prep time, so sorry about that.
Yes.
So space lasers, good topic, right? So I'll talk about what we found last year.
There it is.
So what happens if you think, say, space laser? This happens in my brain. It probably happens in yours as well, right? This is the famous space laser. So you think, the okay, we're not, I don't think I'm going to be over here whacking the space bar and stuff, okay? Folks, right, that's the space laser. Fortunately, those don't exist. But we do have space lasers in real life, but I'll also say, like, what happens when a physicist a laser is an actual acronym, like it's light emitted by stimulated emission. So this is what happens in the laser, right? So here's my laser, nice and small. And so you have a medium of some kind, you put a mirror on one side, you put a almost perfect mirror on the other side, and then you put a coil around it that emits light and raises the energy in the of all the electrons in the medium that you've got here. And so there's ruby lasers, for example. I think this is neon lasers. There's different kinds of materials that you can use for this. And as soon as one of these things drops a photon and it starts traveling in this direction, the big thing that Einstein and others found out was that as the light goes by one, they go, oh, that's a great idea. I'll also emit a photon. And so all the atoms start getting stimulated, right? The emission comes by and they go, oh, yeah, here's another photon to go. And so you start bumping these back and forth so you get the light with the exact same frequency, the exact same color, which is why lasers look, uniquely one color. And you get them, so they drop from, the electron drops from one orbit to the next, and all these start getting the same idea. So photons, one of those lights comes by. It keeps bumping back and forth. So that's how it works in here, right? So this is how we all control all of that. Now, funny enough, nature has a way of doing this as well, but in a completely different setting. So this can actually happen in space naturally. You may have heard of there's a nuclear reactor, there's a naturally occurring nuclear reactor underneath the ground in Africa. And that happens, well, if you just have enough the right combinations, then this will happen, right? So if you happen to be a whole bunch of molecules of the same kind and the right kind of emission comes by, then you can have something like this, like a laser as well. Now, why don't we see blinking lights like that in the sky? Because the natural occurring one we see in radio. So we have a very particular color, we have green, we have red, ruby lasers, but we also have radio lasers, and they are called masers, which is microwave. So it's exactly the same way as your microwave. So, back to the space bar again. You need a power source. Well, fortunately, the universe will provide. Here is, young star-forming galaxy, star-forming region. So all these stars here have just formed. And you've got a nice, dense medium nearby. So you've got the same kind of molecules, lots of them nearby, and you've got everything illuminated by young stars. So you see this is the radio telescope I've been working with for, let's see, a year before my daughter was born, so she's in seventh grade, a while, right? So it was this for the longest time. This is the cap draw. I just put it in years draw. Like, look, it's going to be great, right? If they have nothing else to show except for some broken bits and wires. But it actually just got better and better. So this is a little video that they made of like what this is going to look like. So the Meerkat Radio Telescope is located in South Africa, and it is built in a particular area of the Karoo Desert. It's nice and dry. There's nobody there, which is awesome because people tend to walk around with these things and not bat the radio telescopes. So no radio, nobody there really. And so they built 64 of these things in essentially a little valley with all these little low hills around it, so you don't even get line of sight, other issues. And so that's what I kept pointing to, like, look how great this is going to be, but the best part is it is built and it has now been operating for a little over a year now, so we're getting data. So South Africa has its own radio telescope. And the neat thing is that you have that access to the sun in the sky. So they went from the Cat 7, with the original prototype, and then they have like all these buildings. It's a big project, right? There's 64 of these things, lots of data streaming towards Cape Town. They have a very slick graphics team, as you can tell, right? So why do I have such a slick graphics team that, you know, trying to convince a whole bunch of people that this is a great place to put a radio telescope? Well, they were in direct competition with the Australians. And if you know anything about South Africa, cricket, or rugby, you know that there are two mortal enemies in cricket and rugby, and that is India and Pakistan, but the other two mortal enemies are South Africa and Australia. So there was a bit of friendly rivalry going on, and so yes, this was one bid to get the big project to come to South Africa, and the Australians are doing the same thing. So this is sort of a proof of concept. We can actually build this thing, and also please build it here. And now we have, you know, this is the very first one 2 years ago, but now there's 64 of these. To give you an idea, this is 12 and a half feet, and I have to multiply this by 35 foot across these things, so they're pretty sizable. This is, you know, your car fits under here just fine. And so they're pretty sizable dishes. We built bigger ones, but 64 of them in combination makes a pretend to be one large one. So you dot them around the landscape, and then they sort of work together to be a big dish. So it works. That's great. That's portable. What are you going to do with it? Are you going to look for space lasers? No, we weren't. As soon as you have one, you can have more. And so the thing now actually looks like the promo video that we saw earlier. And the whole point of this was to get eventually the square kilometer array. And so, yes, sorry, metric. this is a European project. And they want the total surface area of all the radio stuff that they're going to put in South Africa to be a square kilometer in surface area, which is, I don't know, half a square mile? I don't know what it is in football fields.
It's about a third.
Still don't know how much of that is in football fields, but that's the other thing, right? So give you an idea who's involved. Notice that we're not, because, you know, America likes to build their own things, but everybody else sort of bundled together to build this square kilometer array. And the neat thing is, it's not just going to be in South Africa. See all the purple countries here. It's like most of Southern Africa. Everybody gets a few of those dishes, and then the whole thing is essentially the whole area is like it is in Southern half of Africa. So you have a really powerful instrument, and you can train engineers and scientists. And so this is why all these African countries are on board as well, and why this is such a big rivalry, right? looking at the distant universe with the meerkat array. We're quite proud of that acronym because this means something in Zulu. This is what you shout goal with soccer. That's what you shout in Zulu. And this is in 2010, by the way. The Soccer World Cup was in Cape Town. So we all were sort of riding the high of the the Soccer World Cup. And this is a trumpet that you sort of trumpet if you're, you know, a soccer fan in South Africa. It's a big honking thing. I've heard enough of those things by now, but that sort of became our logo. So that's our project. The three of us that have been working on it. I went on maternity leave and sort of handed Sarah Blythe, who's one of the other PIs, like the proposal, to finish it, and she was just coming back from maternity leave. So we both have a kid that's about as old as this project. And don't worry, I'm not spending a lot of time on math or anything. That's not going to happen. But what we're looking for is radio emission from hydrogen. Hydrogen is everywhere, right? It's one of the things that came out of the Big Bang, so hydrogen is the thing that we're looking for. And it's because it has a neat little trick that if you just have a hydrogen atom here, it has one electron, and this is quantum mechanics, it's got the electron can spin up or it can spin down, and there's a little energy difference between up and down. So if it flips from up to down, it actually emits a little bit of light. It emits a little bit of radio light that is 21 centimeters in wavelength. And that's the thing that we're looking for, because we want to know where all the hydrogen in the universe is, right? So galaxies made stars out of hydrogen gas. They keep doing it. Where do they keep getting the hydrogen from? How much fuel do they have left in the tank? That's our goal, right? This is the science that we wanted to do. So this is not the laser. And so this is sort of like a little map of the universe where all these little galaxies are, like further and further away. And so we're looking out, and our plan was to go like, all right, we're just going to look through like a slice of the heavens and find, you know, galaxies and then their gas. So we sort of predicted like, yeah, we'll see lots of them, and you know, we'll find lots of Milky Way-like galaxies and the amount of gas that they have. However, never underestimate serendipity in astronomy. Part of the reasons we do the things we do is because that's what we ended up seeing. So we expected there wasn't a prediction like, yeah, you might see one or two, maybe. We didn't expect that to be the first thing to pop out of the data, so we got 5 points for sheer dumb luck. So this is the first thing that we found. Instead of the hydrogen blitz that we were expecting, we saw one giant line predicting a point. And so we found a mega major, and not only that, we found it at, you know, the most distant point, like twice the distance that anybody had found one before. And so we ran a little a naming competition in South Africa, you know, extra points for South African names, and we came up with Impelakaka, which is in Zulu again, and it means big boss, and we just had to check that it didn't mean mob boss. And especially none of the, well, Sarah Zulu is, you know, and she had Zulu in high school, and she was like, well, it was more Kota, so I don't know. And so we had to check some of our collaborators. And so we went to a pop song, so that worked pretty well. It's not a, you know, like in radio, radio has a PR problem, you know, it only thing that can make these little contour lines, you go like, here's a source here, and go, yay! It's never a pretty picture like How Below James Webb. So, but we did find it, there's a little line, it came out almost immediately, so it's a record. And not only that, it's already weird. So as soon as you look for something further away, the light from there takes longer to get to us, so we're looking at an older picture. So the further and further you look, you start looking at like younger and younger stuff. At some point you get baby pictures of all the galaxies. So the further you look, the younger the galaxies that you're looking at. And so we have to have these really special circumstances to have this line happen. And it's supposed to be, you know, whopping star formation, lots of big young stars, lots of dense gas. And then we sort of find this thing as like a boring, yellowish, not forming stars at all galaxy, as far as we can tell. So this was strange, right? So And so you can see, like, lots of young stars, lots of dense gas. Okay, that makes sense. And then what's the next one going to look like? This one's also one. Here, well, here's your dense gas, here's your star formation, right? So it's definitely in there. All the ingredients are there. But the other thing you notice, they don't look like your normal galaxies. They look like these guys. So they look like something that is sort of undergoing a merger of two galaxies coming together. Now, we don't see this whole thing, the whole process happen. This takes, you know, 2 billion years. Funding agency light results within the year, so problem. And so what we do is, like, well, these look like a little bit like this. So we sort of play Pictionary, right, where we put them in the right order and think, like, this sort of seems like a logical, but these are different galaxies at different stages of the merger. And we can do that by, let me play. Yeah, okay, it's like, fantastic. Sorry, lots of technical issues, so I wouldn't be surprised if one of the movies sort of stopped. So this is what we do, like, we have this simulation in the computer, and then we compare it to Hubble pictures, and we can go, like, well, we can change camera angle, so, you know, and we keep running time forward. So these are two sort of Milky Way sized galaxies, we smash them together, change the camera angle again. Yeah, that looks like these two, right? So we start to understand, we're pretty confident we understand how smashing two galaxies together works. And apparently at some phase during this, there is a point where the conditions are just right to have this whole thing be a mega major. So really big thing. It's sort of like they peak in star formation, right, when they're sort of merging like this, and there's tidal tails coming off. It's usually, it's not subtle when two galaxies merge, right? It's not a, like, oh, I wonder if those, nope, that's definitely happening there, right? So, this is a slightly older simulation. I do like the fact that we just keep switching back and forth between the Hubble pictures and the simulation, so you can kind of go, like, yeah, depends a little bit on which way we're looking, we have no control over that, and at what time of the simulation we're looking at. Now, these are already a little smoother, because, you know, as computers get stronger and bigger, people make better movies with, they make better simulations, but mostly better movies. and so you get things like, well, you can sort of see, like, how time is progressing here, and why R means mega year or millions of years. So you can see how long this takes and how happy we are to run this in a computer. But you can see that this is a gas, and the neat thing is, like, well, you actually see that lots of gas gets smashed together. So it's like lots of energetic gas sort of, you know, pumped up already. And so you just have to have a funnel go through and the whole thing will become a major. So this is a very good way to get there. How did we get a galaxy at redshift 0.5, which, by the way, is 3 billion light years away, how did we get that boring-looking galaxy to actually start mating us? So, it is not a merger. So maybe it's a merger, maybe it's not, we can't tell yet, but there's definitely, and I'll have one more movie because I like this one, because this is made for the Milky Way, so the Milky Way and sister galaxy, Andromeda should appear in the picture any time now. So here we're in the Milky Way, and here's Andromeda. As it happens, Andromeda is on a collision course with the Milky Way. No need to be alarmed. Again, this takes several billion years. It's a good shot. The sun has gone out by the time these two things have actually collided. But you can see it down here, right? 3 billion years. Still haven't actually hit each other yet. And one of the neat things I find when this happens, it looks like a collision, it feels like a collision, none of the stars actually hit each other. There's so much space between them that they just whoosh past. But they do have gravity on it, they work with gravity on each other, so they alter course. So there's no stellar collisions, but they all go on different Milky orbits. So it might happen that we have a space laser at some point in our own Milky Way. Well, at some point, you know, 6.6 billion years from now, so not really a problem. So that's how we understand how space lasers happen in our local universe. Now, the student, Ms. Roberts, is working on her PhD, so she was working on, like, how many do we actually expect, so you get plots like redshift, how far away, and how sensitive are we to these things, and probably at the end of the survey, the deepest we're going to look, we're going to see just as many OH majors as we're going to actually see the thing that we were looking for. That was the result of the paper. It's like, oh, we might accidentally have a major survey that we occasionally find some gas in, rather than our gas survey where we occasionally find an OH major in. So I'm not really sure what my job is at this point. But we did find, Joppa had a prediction of where the color is supposed to be, and our target OM is right on there. It's pretending exactly to be like the ones in our local universe, except that it looks boring. So, Hubble, this is the best resolution we have so far. And so this is a picture that we took with Hubble of the same thing, and you see that there's one galaxy here, and there's something, a second one here. This is actually an interaction, but it looks pretty dull on the ground based picture. So far, the mechanism seems to work. This is a good way to find where galaxies are smashing into each other, and apparently you need to have that in order to have an OH megamajor. And so I keep saying OH, and I realize I haven't explained what I mean with OH. We're here imbibing not OH, but OH is one oxygen molecule and one hydrogen molecule. That has a nice radio line that you can have, and that's the medium that we're using for these two, the space lasers. Sorry, I should have mentioned that earlier. So that's the way we get, things like alcohol and water and a whole bunch of chemical organic molecules, but it means that, something complex with benzene rings and stuff, that all happens in space now, and OH is quite common. So it's a common molecule, it happens in thick clouds, and then you have a bright star nearby to, excite it up, and then you only have to have one photon going your way, and the next thing you know, you have a laser happening. So that's what we think is happening, and we managed to give it a cool name as well, so there we are. This is a little sneak peek, by the way, right? This is not officially released yet, the picture from Hubble, we just got it. And so the takeaway is, we found lasers happen naturally, which is still boggles my mind a little bit because I still feel like it's super artificial, but it's not, right? They happen naturally. So we found one by sheer dumb luck. But luck had a favor to the prepared, right? We were warned that this might happen, and so we were looking for bright blips. It was like, well, let's check if this is an OH mega laser. And the merging galaxy seems the way to make it. So that's how you get. For half an hour, because that's my own fear pretentious fan, and I expect somebody to have a question at this point. We're about to see a lot more. So the other takeaway, of course, is that AFRAG is doing fantastic scientific work right now, and so this is the kind of thing to keep an eye out. The groups of people that are coming out of it, the students that are being trained, it's really fun to watch that. So, with that, thank you very much for your attention, and I'll take questions. Again, see through this stuff. It's just in the way. And I know there's stars and things behind here in, so this is the fun part, space is still not very dense. So you can have stuff live forever because there's nothing else to react with. The other molecule is like a meter or two away. So, sorry, I keep going back to metric. It's several feet away. And that's the density, right?
Make
so,
it miles.
Yeah, 4 miles. So this is a dense cloud in interstellar space. Still better than any vacuum you've made on Earth. And so it doesn't get blown apart by the intense UV light because there's enough of it around it. The space being big and empty, we really mean it when we say big, and we really mean it when we say empty. So it's really empty, but it's also big enough that it's a giant cloud. So you end up with enough molecules to do it. But it's, yeah, you're quite right. If this were in a normal atmosphere, it would react out to itself immediately.
Correct.
You can go even one step more extreme for the chemists here in the room. Astronomers are able to observe so-called forbidden stages or transitions, which you would never see in a lab on Earth, because there's nothing there to prevent those transitions.
So usually when you have an atom, you knock a couple of electrons off, right? It reunites with the electrons almost immediately, because
yep.
You know, density. But in space, it's like, yep, you lost your electron, now it's miles away. And so it just sits there forever, long enough to give up an X-ray signature, for example. So yeah, you get some strange chemistry. All right, yes?
Now that we've learned that these lasers are out there, and we know how to look for them, where do we go from here?
Ah.
What's next?
Oh, my favorite question. I was going to ask a student as well. So this might be a good way to find galaxies that are merging. And we don't know how often they've been merging in the past. It's sort of an open question. So if I find the same number of OH masers in a locus, like nearby, I'm using nearby incredibly loosely, right? Nearby, like other galaxies that we can take pretty Hubble pictures of. And I look like really far away, and I see the same number for cubic part of the universe. That means that the merger rate is roughly the same. Or we could see a lot more, and that means that they've been merging much more enthusiastically in the past. It's unclear, but we think that's how the universe makes these elliptical blobby galaxies. And if that works, we should be seeing a lot more of these things, halfway through the cross universe. So it's like we should be seeing more in the distant past. So it'll be interesting to see if that's actually true. Because one is great, it's a wonderful discovery, but it's not statistics. So that's what we're going to do next. Please give me more questions. Yes?
No directionality, right?
Pardon?
No directionality.
Oh, this, yeah. So it's one. So our project is really stare at one part in space for as long as you humanly can, or with a telescope. And so we've got 300 hours in one band, and I think about the same number in the other. So we've already stared for about 600 hours at this batch. We're going to stare for about 3,000. So I think this might be the longest a telescope has sort of like peered at one point so far. I'm not really 100% sure of that, because I think some X-ray telescopes have done that. So I can't quite make the claim, but yeah, we've looked at one spot. There's another survey that's actually trying to do the whole thing. Yeah.
Different question about directionality. So the maser has a direction to point, right?
Yeah.
So that should actually have effect on the probability to find something. I'm really surprised that the numbers are that high from that spot, from this student that you...
Okay, we're getting into the nitty-gritty. So we don't really know how much direction the maser has, right? So if you have a medium that's simulated, just because it's a giant cloud and you're docking from one end to the other, you can also do this from top to bottom. And so
you would expect maybe to get a whole bunch of laser beams, so to say?
Going every which way, yeah.
Okay.
But it is coherent, right? So the thing is the coherence that's noticeable, because you see it as one emission line. You see it as one
yep.
frequency. But it isn't like this, right? So we think laser, it's a little dot on the wall, right? We just happen to see the dot on the wall.
not like jazz.
It's not like jazz. It's not elevated. It's probably got. I was a little worried because astronomers like to, you know, use the spherical cow. Everything is spherical until proven otherwise. Sure, but these galaxies are complex, so they might have some directionality to it, which will affect the numbers quite a bit.
Yeah.
So, this is why it's like.
And the other thing is, if you expect with almost every kind of OH detection or hydrogen detection at that redshift to find a major, how does it work with the percentage of mergers you have in a certain galaxy population? Because you don't have 100% mergers, right? You have a certain part of your galaxy population merging a certain part.
Stuff. Okay, this is an exercise in stuff we don't know, right? So, A, we don't know how many of our galaxies are actually smashing together, right? So that's a fraction, sort of like 20% or anywhere. I'll get to it in a second, okay? Yes, we don't know how that is at that distance just yet. Then we don't know how long during that merger it's making main thing, right? So we don't know how long we can actually see it like that. And then the last part is, we don't know if you can see them in every direction or are you missing some because they're, you know, just beaming out of our line of sight. So there's a whole bunch of unknowns, and this is why that model is so, you know, it's a bit, yeah, that's sort of what the guess that we have so far. And so it will be interesting to see what numbers we actually get, and then we can compare to what we think how this works. You had a question.
So the merger in this
two galaxies that flow together. So you have two rotating disks of stars, and they what we mean with a merger is like they look like separate things, and by the end of it they sort of mush together into a new galaxy. That's what we call.
And they remain as that new singular entity rather than packing through each other.
Yeah.
And becoming two sort of new things.
Yeah, that's what you would think. If they go fast enough, this will happen. But usually two galaxies end up not quite hitting each other face on, but they sort of skim, and then that slows them down enough that after like two or three passes, they do actually end up.
So when we say merger, we do mean that final singular form, or final.
Well, the whole process to get to that block, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Awesome. Yep. Out of my team or out of all of them? Cause
just the facility in general, other cool science.
So it's been looking. It's looked at the center of our Milky Way, for example. I've made a really great picture of that, so you can actually look at the neighborhood of the supermassive black hole. It made a really great picture of that. There are. Let's see, we're looking at nearby galaxies to look at how they're getting fuel, so like little gas trickles coming in. It's fantastic for that. That's the project that's currently getting its first data, so, you know, it's still happening. What else has happened? They found a lot of supermassive black holes in the distant universe. They blare in radio at all frequencies, so it's like a loud siren, and so you can pick them out, and they even have the jets coming out of it. And I think the coolest thing that has recently happened was they saw the signal of a star getting shredded by a supermassive black hole that does a little blip. And the whole star basically disappears in the thing in a span of a few minutes. And that has it gives off a radio scream of, you know, that you can see halfway across the universe. So they found one of those as well. There's, you know, new stuff coming out all the time. It's kind of fun to be.
Is there any high redshift stuff?
This is the high redshift stuff. So.
High redshift.
So radio is hard because it's a faint signal, and we also live on a very noisy planet. So between those two things, it's hard to look far, far away. And so when Hubble gets the redshift 8, 9, James Webb gets the redshift 12, 13, we're going.
going, we got to redshift 0.2. So whenever you talk to a radio astronomer, they're a high redshift. You got to get that all from the rest of them. But you know what? This is hard, and you do it. So no, it's kind of neat because we're the further back you look, you can actually see the base. Like you can see galaxies from long ago, see how much gas they had, how much fuel they had to make new stars. So that's our goal at the moment. That was our science goal, but this is sort of a like fun first find. And so yeah, we found it all and we qualified a mega major. So all right, any other questions? Yes.
So yeah. Let's say someone wanted to upgrade the facility from West Virginia for this. What's the kind of scale of that undertaking to try to get to like this level?
So we have something that's sort of that level but needs new. So there's a couple of components. The most visible part is the big dish, right? That's metal. Metal just sits there and it's fine, and as long as you keep painting it, it won't rust. So that's okay. Or if you put it in the desert, even better, it definitely won't rust. So that's not the thing that needs upgrading. It is the receiver at the top and the electronics at the back end. And that's more expensive than you think, and it doesn't look as cool because you can't cut a ribbon next to a big machine. So that's the part that would need upgrading. There is it's in front of Congress. So yeah. We'll see how that goes.
You might not want to put it into West Virginia.
No, it's
you want to put it into VLA.
Right.
Well,
that's what I meant. Like the one
yeah.
in the one in the.
Now there's a reason for that. It's nice to have your 100-meter dish Virginia, but the BLA has several dishes which you can move much shorter away than 100 meters, much more resolution.
So there's a proposal for that. It also would include a couple of dishes in Puerto Rico. To you may have heard of the Arecibo, big shame because that was a really useful facility, right? It's never. Anyway, the plan is to have a couple of those out in the iron dishes in Puerto Rico for the next generation. And Congress people like this, especially if you happen to put a dish in their own state, where they're going to be like, look, I brought this. So,
I certainly not as interesting as a cabinet full of
computers.
Right?
Yeah, no, it's fine. The computer stuff from the Meerkat is also quite ingenious, right? They run a lot of it on effectively foam components. Because they're smaller, and smaller means that you don't have to have to cool it as much. And then they did another clever thing. They sort of cooled the whole thing with transmission oil. So it's a whole array of like essentially Nokia phone internals, and that's their supercomputer, and that's right on site. The neat thing is that what a radio telescope sees, if it has electronics, it's mostly its own electronics. If you don't watch out, so you have to shield everything. So they are now experts in shielding this stuff, and it turns out that most navies like to shield what their electronics are doing as well. So you get some really alarming people at the radio telescope once in a while. So yeah, there's overlap between the defense industry and South Africa had its own defense industry for a long time. But now they're doing this, which is much better. So
I just wanted to make a comment, which actually plays with what you said about the high redshift and why radio is 0.2 and happy and gets laughed at. One of the big disadvantages of radio is when you see that hydrogen is already 21 centimeters and you have to multiply it with 1 point whatever the redshift is, it moves very quickly from technology to technology.
Yep.
That doesn't happen in the optical and the near infrared. So these optical and near-infrared detectors have a much wider window to observe how your line moves with this. So in radio, you go from one receiver technology to the other just to make small, sorry, small jumps in